Okay, as we normally do, we always start a class with review, so we'll begin here this morning. You have some questions to do for this morning. I think questions 40 through 43. So let's go through those, and hopefully you've had a chance to do the questions. If not, you can listen to the responses. Let's start with question 40, and I'll ask for this question. Any volunteers for question 40?
Vineyard and wine.
Okay, question 40. Isaiah uses two pictures to describe God's relationship to Israel. Gave you a few verses. These are not the only verses. What are they?
One is the beloved.
Okay, the beloved. So God is the husband. Israel is the wife. You saw that in chapter 54. Well, I haven't got there. 54, 5, 6. But we also talked about it in chapter 1. Remember? Talking about Jerusalem and describes her as the harlot. You know, she was the beloved. Now she's the harlot. So here you have the husband-wife relationship. And what is the second one? The vineyard, right. And so God is the husbandman or the vine dresser. He takes care of the vineyard. Israel is described as the vineyard. He nourished it. He developed it. And we talked about that, I think, on Wednesday night. Okay, chapter 5. Let's go to question number 41. And we covered this on Wednesday in chapter 5. There are six woes pronounced in this chapter, starting 5. Verses 8 through 23. What are the six woes? John Whitehead?
Against the three land forces, against strong ground, against defense toward God, against those who call in good, against the sea, and against those who practice injustice.
Okay, good. And those are very short woes. And hopefully as we look at these that, you know, we make application in our life. I find it very interesting when we study the Old Testament how, and I think I mentioned this on Wednesday, how we have a problem in our society today with drugs and alcohol. You know, they had that same problem here, you know, number 2, warned against a strong drink. Okay, question 42. Let me, Arthur, would you, question 42. What was the event, what is the event and the date when Isaiah saw the heavenly vision and received his call to prophetic work?
It's the year of King Uzziah's death, and the year was 739.
Very good. Death of King Uzziah, 739. All right, let's do question 43. Todd, Aldridge, 43. In chapter 6, Isaiah utters a phrase to Jehovah about his willingness to go to work. What is the phrase?
Here I am, send me.
Exactly. Here I am, send me, in verse 8. Okay, let's do a past question. We covered this, I think, either on Wednesday or the previous class. Let's go to question number 37. Sally, how about 37? It says in chapter 2, when will the mountain of the Lord be established? Use scripture to interpret when this will occur.
The mountain of the Lord will be established in the last days, which is of the Jewish dispensation.
Okay, so it's in the last days, period of the end of the Jewish dispensation. Did you have any scriptures there to... Okay. We talked about that. And in this particular case, we use scriptures from various different books to help us identify the time frame. Here it's not really given. It just says in these last days. What are these last days? Remember we went to Daniel chapter 2, verses 28 and 40 and 44. It's not the same phrase, but it says in the later days. Remember Daniel is interpreting the vision of the statue. And each of the parts of the body represent different kingdoms. He gets to the fourth kingdom, and he says, you know, that's the Roman kingdom. And he says, during that king, that the Christ kingdom will be established. It will have no end. And then there's other places. Go to Acts chapter 2, verse 16, and the prophecy that Peter is citing from Joel. We have the same thing, and it shall be in the last days, okay? Here he's talking about they're in the last days. Here these people are interpreting are prophesying about the Christ. This is referring to the same period. And then in Hebrews 1, verses 1 and 2, it says, in the last days, talks about how God spoke through his Son. So those are the three scriptures, or several scriptures you can use. And there's others, not the only ones we could use to identify the time frame. Okay, let's now turn into, we left off, we're in our notebooks on Lesson 10, page 64. Lesson 10, page 64. It's under the second tab, chapters 1 through 39. We didn't finish chapter 6, so we'll go ahead and pick up there where we left off. We left off right around verses 8 and 9. Let me just read 8 through 10 just to recall the things we read on Wednesday. Of course, this chapter is where Isaiah has received his call. This is Isaiah's call. And this last section is, "Here I am, send me." The same phrase that that Todd mentioned. It was that we used to describe this section. So let's pick up verse 8. "Then I heard the voice of the Lord saying, 'Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?' And I said, 'Here I am, send me.' And he said, 'Go and tell this people, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull and their eyes dim, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their hearts and return and be healed.'" In verse 8, the thing I want to mention here is, as we look at verse 8, as Jehovah, the prophet Isaiah, is talking to Isaiah, he says, "Who will go for us?" U.S. Normally when we read that in the Bible, we think, well, that's the Godhead. God is speaking here. Us is the Trinity, right? There's other places, like in Genesis 1, plural is used, talking about the Godhead. In the New American Standard, "us" is capitalized. If you have either of the other versions, "us" is not capitalized. So it's possible it's not talking here about the Trinity, but it's talking about, if it's plural, who is it? Well, it's Jehovah God and all these angels. Remember we talked about in verse 3, verses 2 and 3, here you have all these angels gathered with God. And so maybe talking about his court, the angels and him, is synonyms. So it may not necessarily be the Trinity being referred to. Verses 9 and 10 is kind of interesting here. And just take the second line of verse 9. So Isaiah's supposed to go and preach to the people, and he says, and what is Isaiah supposed to do? Keep on listening, but do not perceive. Here you have several things happening right here. One, he's supposed to go and preach to the people, tell the people, you know, listen to what he has to say. What about this last thing, "but do not perceive"? He's telling the people, don't understand, don't perceive. What we find in these two verses here is the result of Isaiah's preaching. He's going to go ahead and tell the people, keep on listening, keep on looking. But what are the people going to do? They're not going to perceive. They're not going to understand. They're not going to be willing because of their hearts to listen to the word. So here you have his work and then the result of his work. People are not going to perceive for the most part, not going to understand. Their hearts are going to be insensitive. Their ears are dull. You know, he's trying to change that, but in most part, he's not going to be very successful. The people are still going to be like he describes. And isn't that kind of interesting how right here Isaiah's getting his call. He's getting his mission to go preach. The Lord's going to tell him, well, look, they're not going to listen. They're not going to understand. Their ears are going to be dull. Their eyes are going to be dim. They're not going to be able to see. So he's presenting to Isaiah that his mission of being preached is going to be largely very unsuccessful. But yet, he still has the good attitude. And the Lord, interesting enough, you know, why would the Lord go tell this man to go preach and the Lord knows what the end result is going to be? The people are not going to be listening. Well, I think the answer to that is, for the most part, most of the people aren't going to listen. Most of the people are not going to be perceiving. But remember here about this remnant. We talked about the remnant in chapter 1, verse 9, about how God left a remnant. There's still some righteous people there that are going to listen, are going to perceive. And, the remnant's going to be preserved. But for the most part, most of the people are not going to listen. 11 and 12, we already read. I won't read the entire thing. In the first part of 11, Isaiah asks, "Then I said," and here's a natural question, right? So the Lord's going to say, you go preach, but your work, you're not going to be very successful. People aren't going to listen. He asks, well, how long? And the Lord just goes on and tells him, until the cities are devastated, the house are without people. You just keep on preaching until the desolation comes. Don't stop. All the way to the end. But then you'll find in Isaiah so many times, so you see this picture of people not listening, there's going to be desolation, destruction. Now look at the last part of verse 13 when we read this on Wednesday. He says here, he talks again about this remnant, and yet there'll be a tenth portion in it. There's your remnant. But the remnant's also going to be subject to oppression, and it talks about it being subject to burning, and it's going to fall down like an oak tree. But yet, what do you find the last part of verse 13? The holy seed is its stump. So there's, again, this ray of hope. The holy seed, no doubt talking about the Messiah. The Messiah is still going to come. There's still promise. Still don't give up hope, Isaiah, and also to the righteous people. Keep on listening, because they're, God's still going to keep the seed and through the Messiah. Okay, so that's chapter 6. Let's go on now to the next section. Now we're turning the page to lesson 11 on page 65. Now I want to cover chapter 7 through 10. And again, we're only going to cover sections, only mention key verses here. We're not going to cover every verse like we did chapter 6. Again, if we go ahead and just set the context of this particular set of chapters, 7 through 10, we're still in our first section, which is chapters 1 through 12, the Lord's charge against Judah and Jerusalem. And in this section here, we have our chapter summaries. And if you noted there in your notes under item number D, this is your chapter summary, chapters 7 through 12. Entitled this one here, Messianic Prophecies Intermingled with the Present National Crisis. And we'll talk about that crisis here in a minute. So we're going to find a lot of Messianic prophecies. That's not to say we already covered a lot already to date, but you'll find there continue to be prophecies throughout this section. Okay, so let's get into chapter 7. You can open your Bibles to chapter 7 of Isaiah if you're not already there. And let's start with the first one here, this first section here. And it covers in chapter 7, verses 1 through 16, where we find here's this present national crisis. Here Jerusalem's going to be threatened by Aram or Syria and by Ephraim. And that's in chapter 7, verses 1 through 16. And in this particular section, there's actually some subsections. And so the first subsection here is in this first 9 verses of chapter 7. And Ahaz, who's the king, we know he was the third king during Isaiah's writing. And so let's go ahead and read the first verse here. We're in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 1. One thing you will note here as you look at go to chapter 7, you see that in probably in your Bible how the writing is different here, right? Most of we've covered before, it's all been poetic for the most part. There have been some exceptions, but the lion's share of the work has been poetic. Now we get to chapter 7, and now we're in a narrative section. We're just like in Kings or Chronicles. And so we're back to a narrative type of style of writing. So let's read verse 1. It says, Now it came about in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah, that Rezin, the king of Aram, and Pekah, the son of Ramallah, king of Israel, went to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not conquer it. So here we find another one of our time references. This is actually our third time references. Chapter 6 was our second, and if you go to 1:1 is our first time reference, but here's our third time reference. It says, in the days of Ahaz. Now, one thing might strike you. Remember we did this detailed historical account of the four kings and what happened. You remember at the end of Jotham's reign, this alliance between Aram and the northern kingdom during the last part of Jotham's reign came against Judah. But when you start reading this, it says, and it came about in this days, that almost it sounds like this is potentially another time that this came in. We didn't discuss this in detail when we did the historical account. But this is kind of a detail upon a detail that we'll want to go through. And then when you read through, it says, went to wage war against Jerusalem, but could not conquer it. You remember when we did the historical account that it was widespread oppression. There were over 200,000 captives taken to Damascus. This sounds like it's something a little bit different. And so here in this mention, this is kind of one of the historical accounts. There's possibly here this alliance. There's possibly three invasions by Syria and Ephraim. Let me put those on the overhead. These are actually not in your notes here. But we give the scriptures here for each one of them. First of all, in 2 Kings 15:37, we read, when we did the historical account, you know, this alliance came against Judah. That was at the end of Jotham's reign. That's the first invasion. The second invasion is the one that we remember about the captives and how there was a great oppression where Ahaz was delivered into the hand of king of Syria and great multitudes were taken away. And likely this is the third one. So here on the overhead, there's are possibly the three invasions by Syria and Ephraim. And the one we're studying right here is actually the third invasion. And if you look at the scriptures here, not much is said about this first one at the end of Jotham's reign. It just mentions it. This one here, the second one here is in 2 Chronicles 28:5. And the third one is probably talking about in 2 Kings 5:9 and also in Chronicles. So the Chronicle accounts actually has two, possibly the two invasions. Not, you don't see that break necessarily in 2 Chronicles. But here Isaiah almost indicates that there's actually, these are some differences, you know. We're hearing about this invasion coming. Well, I thought it came during Jotham's reign. So these three invasions possibly explain some of these potential inconsistencies. I don't know if you picked up on those as you read it. But so likely this possibly the third invasion, and Isaiah here 7 is talking about the third invasion. Okay, let's look at verse 2. Let's read verse 2. It says, when it was reported to the house of David saying, the Arameans have camped in Ephraim, his heart and the hearts of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake with the wind. You remember when we did the building blocks of Isaiah, I asked you to read through that. We see this word Ephraim, and that was one of the building blocks in Isaiah. Isaiah, in his book, almost has a separate vocabulary compared to the other prophets. He'll use terms that other prophets do not use, and this is one term, Ephraim. And if you went through those building blocks, you see Ephraim is the same thing as the northern kingdom. Ephraim was, of course, one of the tribes. They evidently came to have a lot of prominence during this time. Joshua came from the tribe of Ephraim. So this was a key tribe that provided a lot of leadership to the country because of what, going back to the days of Joshua. So when he says it's camped in Ephraim, he's talking about the northern kingdom. But you see here how King Ahaz, how scared he is, not only him, but the people. Now think about other prophet or other kings that we know. Would David be like that? Or some of these other, like Josiah, or some of these other kings that were more righteous than Ahaz, likely would be like this. And you can see not only him, but also the people are very, very scareful about this invasion. And possibly they're so scared because if this was the third invasion, you know, they've been thinking, well, look what's already happened in the present. Here's another invasion. And possibly that would have also provided a lot of fear for them. Okay, let's look at verse 3 here. Let's go ahead and read verse 3. Then the Lord said to Isaiah, go now to meet Ahaz. You and your son share Jashub at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the fuller's field. And say to him, take care and be calm. Have no fear and do not be faint-hearted. Because of these two stubs of smoldering firebrands on account of the fierce anger of Rezin and Aram and the son of Remaliah. Okay, so here we went through this when we started our study about looking at Isaiah and his family. So one of his sons has this name, Sherjazah. And if we went through this and you have a little footnote on that word, that means the remnant shall return. Well, what remnant? Likely talking about those captives that were taken captive in Damascus through the second, invasion. And what we find here is Isaiah is telling, you know, don't be afraid. This alliance, this persecution is not going to last. It's going to be done away with. Let me, in verse, 3, we find that, Isaiah is to go to meet Ahaz. And there is some very specifics here talk about where he is to meet Isaiah. In your notebooks, I think on page 35, going way back when we talked about Zion, there was a map of Jerusalem. And in this map of Jerusalem, in a red circle is likely where Isaiah is meeting King Ahaz. He first of all talks about the end of the conduit. These dotted lines are aqueducts. There's an aqueduct over here in Jerusalem, the outline of Jerusalem. There's an aqueduct here that's actually fed by a spring, a natural spring. And it goes all the way, it ends at this pool of Siloam, and also has another name. And likely this is where Isaiah is meeting Ahaz. And right here is this valley of Kidron, and this Fuller's Field is right here in this valley. And then it talks about the highway, at the end of the highway. There's a highway system here, and it starts right here where close to where the end of this conduit meets. So just kind of an interesting archaeology thing that, they know where Isaiah meets. Just a side note here kind of shows the accuracy of the Bible, how written 700 years before Christ, talking about a very specific location, and today, you know, that location is likely where I pointed out. Okay, so we find that, of course, that alliance is not gonna last. And then if you read your, this section here, you know, that, Isaiah tells Ahaz, you know, do not fear. Okay, let's go on now to the next section in here. Okay, let's go to, here chapter 7, drop down to verse 10. This next section here, let me get my slides lined up here. This next section here is a sign. And what the sign is the Lord's sign to Ahaz. And so Isaiah tells Ahaz, you know, don't fear. And then in verse 10, and the Lord spoke to again to Ahaz, saying, we can always stop here. So much information and interesting things here. I thought Isaiah was talking to Ahaz. Verse 10 says, and the Lord spoke. Here we find, and very common through the Bible, that when prophets speak, it's just as if the Lord is speaking. Here the Lord is put instead of Isaiah. Isaiah is talking to him, of course, being a prophet. And the Lord spoke to Ahaz, saying, ask for a sign for yourselves from the Lord your God. Make it as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. And so we have the sign that that Ahaz is asked to just hold on a minute, let me get my slides lined up here. And we know that what happens here is that Ahaz does not give a sign, right? Look at verse 12. But Ahaz says, I will not ask, nor will I test the Lord. So here, Isaiah is saying, okay, the Lord will give you a sign to confirm what he just told you. Ahaz should have listened to Isaiah, but a sign is offered. And so Ahaz says, I'm not gonna ask for a sign. I'm not gonna ask for a sign to show God's promise that he's gonna keep what Isaiah said. And it's so interesting that Ahaz will not rely on God, not ask for the sign, but we know that Ahaz, he goes ahead and he asks for the help from Assyria, king of Syria, to help him during this oppression. And so very, very interesting. Now, after he asks, he says, I'm not gonna give you a sign. Note verse 14. And so now, what we find here in verse 14, so Ahaz is not going to ask for a sign, but the Lord's going to give him a sign. Note verse 14, therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, a virgin will come with child and bear a son, and he will call his name Emmanuel. So here's another point. We've seen this so many times where here we're talking about a historical account way back where Ahaz, and here suddenly the prophet just jumps to the Messianic era. And now instead of giving the sign that Ahaz was supposed to ask, now he's going to give a sign about the virgin birth. And so very, very common. And you might ask the question, well, how does this sign pertain to what was just happening? Evidently, God is showing that, you know, he's going to keep his promises. Remember, this nation is going to be oppressed. And God's going to keep his promise and the covenants that he made to Abraham and the promises he made to David about, you know, keeping the kingdom. You know, preserve the kingdom through the Messiah. And here's the sign. Of course, it's going to be way, way in the future. Okay, let's now go to the last part of chapter 7. And so starting in verse 17.
Rocky, just a note before you do. I find it interesting that here Ahaz is so wicked, so full of unbelief, and yet God, through the prophet Isaiah, is trying to encourage him, trying to draw him in. You know, I think probably we just give up on Ahaz, and yet God is still striving to bring him to faith and cause him to act in a responsible way. Say something about the nature of this God that you've been talking about, this large post you might want to do.
Okay. Okay, so this next section here, starting in verse 17, actually goes through chapter 8, verse 8. And the point here is that Ahaz should fear destruction coming from the Lord and from Assyria, not worry about this alliance that's coming against him. And there is some subsections here, and the first subsection is starting in verse 17 about desolations are promised. Let's pick up verse 17. It says, the Lord will bring on you. Okay, so we just had the promise of Emmanuel, the virgin birth. In verse 17, it says, and the Lord will bring on you and on your people and on your father's house such days as never come since the day of Ephraim separated from Judah, the king of Assyria. So here we find that, you know, here are these promises, desolations are coming, and they're promised, as we read here in verse 17. We know that Assyria eventually would come against them. Jerusalem would be rescued. We know that from King Hezekiah's time frame. But we also remember that eventually the kingdom is going to be taken away through captivity to Babylon. Okay, let's go now. The next subsection here, starting in chapter 8 in Isaiah. Here this is a section where the Lord foretells the destruction of Israel, or the northern kingdom, by Assyria. Let's read verses 1 and 2. It says, then the Lord said to me, take for yourself a large tablet and write on it in ordinary letters. Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. So what we find here in verse 1 is this phrase here. You might call this an enigma. You know, as we read it, do we know what it means? Swift is the booty, speedy is the prey. We don't know that. Likely the people didn't know what he meant. And in verse 2, and I will take to myself faithful witnesses for testimony, Uriah the priest and Zechariah, the son of Jeberechiah. So Isaiah takes these two witnesses, writes this thing on this big tablet, evidently just for all the people to see. What does this all mean? Verse 3, so I approached the prophetess, of course that's his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to a son. And the Lord said to me, name him Maher Shalah Habaz. For before the boy knows how to cry out, my father or my mother, the wealth of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be carried away before the king of Assyria. So here we find Isaiah prophesying about the destruction of the northern kingdom. Call it Samaria, Ephraim, the northern kingdom, and it's going to be happening by the king of Assyria. And so Isaiah here in this particular case, the Lord through Isaiah gives him two signs. This is going to happen. And the time frame we see here is very short, right? She's conceived the son, so the son has been born. And before he can cry out, my father or my mother, this destruction of the northern kingdom is going to come. And so this is just right around the corner, just in a few years. And so the enigma, swift as the booty, speedy as the prey, now we can understand it. We know what the booty is. Booty is the spoil when a kingdom or army comes in, takes the spoil. Booty, spoil, same thing. That taking of all the plundering of the nation is going to happen very, very quick. The prey, of course, is going to be both the northern kingdom and Damascus. And they're going to be taken away as a prey. It is going to happen very, very quickly. And, of course, you can see, like we mentioned, just in a few years after Isaiah says this. And what happened, of course, we know one of the kings, the Assyrian kings, we know that from 2 Kings 15:29, Tiglath-Pileser actually came and conquered the northern kingdom and also inflicted Damascus and that kingdom of Syria, or also known as Aram. Okay. In your notebooks also, I provided, when we think about Assyria, when we think about world empires, we always think Babylon's a big world empire, the Medo-Persian is a big world empire. Sometimes we may not have a great appreciation. Assyria was also a very wide empire. In your notebooks, I think you had this map in your notebooks in the historical section. And it kind of shows you the outline of the world empires and their reign. And so you probably can't see it very well. Maybe look at your map. But this yellow portion right here is where the Empire of Babylon conquered. And so all this country and the Sinai Peninsula. But look at Assyria, where I have my laser pointer. You know, they conquered part of Egypt and all this particular area. And the Medo-Persian Empire is actually a lot more extensive, actually further than either two kingdoms. Well, my point is, look at Assyria. It had greater territory than Babylon. So it was a very feared army at this time. And, you know, Isaiah has used a lot of scriptures to this point to describe how fierce they were. And so definitely they were someone to fear about. Okay, so within this section here, Let's go now to chapter 8, and let's look at verse 9. Chapter 8, verse 9. Let's just read this first verse. This section here is that again, the Lord should be feared and not the enemy nations. And we have a subsection here that says, fear and listen to the Lord. Chapter 8, verse 9. Now, here we find something very interesting. Let's just read the first two verses here and note several things. So here's Isaiah writing. He says, be broken, O peoples, and be shattered, and give ear, all remote places of the earth. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Gird yourselves, yet be shattered. Devise a plan, but it will be thwarted. State a proposal, but it will not stand. For God is with us. Here we find, as you read verse 9 here, the word peoples. It refers to nations. The King James version has far countries. And so here Isaiah is telling, what is he telling? He's not here talking to Judah and Jerusalem or even the northern kingdom. He's talking about all the surrounding countries, all around the northern and the southern kingdom. And he's saying, you listen, people. What's going to happen is, he says, you know, don't come against God's people. You can devise whatever plan. You know, God is with us. What's so interesting about this section here, remember we talked about who does Isaiah write the book to? We say it was primarily Judah and Jerusalem, but we had a lot of other second recipients. See, Isaiah is making an appeal to all the other nations. Don't come against God's people. God is going to be with his people. And so you find this kind of unique here, that kind of helps us understand that Isaiah was not solely written to Judah and Jerusalem. Definitely the northern kingdom would be very interested by what we just read in the first part, but all the other countries should take care about coming against God, because as it says in the last part of verse 10, God is with us. Okay. Now, within this section, let's go to chapter 9 now. And we talked, we're not going to read the entire section because we just don't have time. Now let's go to chapter 9. And again, what we find starting in chapter 9 here through verse 7, again, we jump back to the Messianic era here. And so this particular section here is about the birth and the reign of the Prince of Peace. It's all Messianic. Now, I talked about this, preached on it on the 23rd of December. And a lot of the things I'm going to would say now, I basically said during the sermon. So if you were here, I think a lot of you were here for that sermon. We talked about this section of text. If you weren't here, the audio tape is available, and you can go ahead and listen to it. So very important section here, but because I already covered it, for sake of time, I'm just want to cover a couple of points here about this section. And then the rest of it, I'll leave. If you're interested, go listen to the tape, or if you were here on the 23rd, you remember the section we talked about quite a bit in detail. There are two things, though, that I do want to talk about in this section here. Some time ago, for those who have email, I sent out an audio file for you to listen. And it was a symphony. And the symphony was Handel's Symphony of the Messiah. And I asked you to listen to that and asked you, where was that taken from? And, of course, it's right here in Isaiah 9, chapter 6. It says, for a child will be born to us, a very famous particular passage. Then I also asked you an email. For those who didn't have email, you didn't get the request. I also asked you to develop two lists. I said, what is the list of things said about the Messiah? Use the New American Standard. And then go and do the same thing with the King James Version. And if you did that, you notice that the lists are different. So if you do the American Standard, look at 9:6, there's five things that are all talked about here. And the American Standard King James actually has six. More than five, there's actually six. And what this particular version does is under numbers 2 and 3, they actually split it. Whereas the New American Standard puts it as one. Wonderful Counselor, and American Standard, King James actually have two items. And so there's actually six attributes described here. The manuscripts that were developed using the American Standard, King James, of course, were much earlier than the New American Standard. And they really believe that the Hebrew word that encompasses Wonderful Counselor is actually meant to be together. So there's actually, should be really Wonderful Counselor and not a separate item. So that's just a thing that I had you to do to note. It's always good to look at different versions. And if you did that, you notice that there's some differences there. And that explains why there is a difference. The second thing I do want to talk to you about in 9:6 is probably the one most difficult thing about 9:6 is this phrase that's talked about Jesus or the Son of God. He say that he is the, calls it here in 9:6. He talks about him being the eternal Father. And I talked about this on Sunday, on the 23rd in the sermon. And there's actually two possible interpretations. And I provided one. I also want to show you a second one. We know when it says eternal Father, right? We know that's not God the Father, right? It's talking about Christ. And we know God the Father, you know, they're two separate beings. So we know right away it's not God the Father. We also know Father is not being used in the sense of Father, Son, biological. Of course, that's obvious that. But Father is also used in other places of the Bible and as a provider or sustainer. And in the sermon, I mentioned Genesis chapter 45, verse 8, where Joseph is called a father to Pharaoh. Okay, what does it mean, a father to Pharaoh? It was that he was, you know, he's helping the nation. He's a provider. He's a sustainer by his planning, you know, getting ready for the famine. And I suggested in the sermon there that, you know, that's possibly how the Christ is meant to be. He is our eternal provider, sustainer, provider of course, spiritual life. And it also not only shows that, but also shows his eternal nature, right? We've talked about a son being born. Well, it has a beginning. But here, this particular phrase, he's eternal. And that shows us the incarnation, right? He was always existing as a being, but he had a fleshly beginning. A son will be born to us. A second interpretation that Steve brought out, also want you to be aware of, is, and this is not obvious by looking at our Bibles here, but scholars who've looked at the Hebrew language have suggested that there may be a problem with the interpretation eternal father. And probably a more appropriate interpretation would be father of eternity or eternal being. When we look at eternal father, eternal is an adjective, modifying father, eternal. But it may be kind of almost the other way around. And so what it's really talking about here, that he is a possessor of what precedes the Father. So he is a possessor of eternity. And there's other places in the Bible where that's being used. There's several scriptures. There's one here you can write down, 2 Corinthians 1:3. It doesn't have the words inverted, but it has, you know, Father of mercies. What does that mean? Father of mercies. So, you know, as a Father who's full of mercy, full of comfort. And so this second interpretation still has eternity, but it's just, you know, it's just, he's an eternal being, period. So he is a father of eternity, not that, so two interpretations for y'all to consider and think about. Appreciate Steve pointing that out to me. Okay, let's go on now to the, our next section here. You see, as we do this sectional type analysis, because Isaiah is so long here, we just can't cover every verse. We're just picking up key verses here. Okay, so now let's go to, let's go on to this next section after Isaiah chapter 9. And we're starting in verse 8. In this particular section, again, we find messianic. Now he's going to come back here in verse 8. And the Lord sends a message against Jacob, and it falls on Israel, and all the people know it. That is Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, asserting in pride and arrogance of heart. Here we find the reason. Why is the northern kingdom going to be cut off? Why is it going to be destroyed? Well, he talks about here, because of their pride and because of their arrogance. And so that's, this section. Okay, let's now move on to, chapter 10, the last chapter here. Now here in this chapter 10 through verse 34, we find that this section is about Assyria is going to be the rod of God's anger. That let's look at starting chapter 10 and let's look at verse 1. And this first section here is a warning here, another woe. You know, how many woes are there in Isaiah? We've already talked a lot of woes. Here's another woe. It says in verse 1, woe to those who enact evil statutes, those who constantly record unjust decisions. And so here we find this woe being mentioned about those who persist in wickedness. And the next section is where we actually find the Assyria section. And so what will God do? God's going to use Assyria as an instrument of judgment. And note verse 5. He says, "Woe to Assyria, the rod of my anger, and the staff in whose hands is my indignation." So here we find Assyria, this kingdom that's going to bring this oppression, described as a rod. God is using this rod, of course, to discipline his people, and of course he's angry as a rod of my anger. We find here that Assyria is going to be used, but we find here also that but this is a woe to Assyria. Assyria is going to bring oppression, but yeah, now we find that there's a woe to the country that's going to bring this oppression. You might say, well, isn't that kind of interesting here? Here's a country God is using to bring against his people because of their iniquities. He brings them, but he's also going to hold them accountable. And why does he do that? What's the problem now with Assyria? And he kind of describes that in verse 2. "So as to deprive the needy of justice and rob the poor of my people of their rights, in order that the widows may be their spoil and that they may plunder the orphans." And so we find here that, because of this nation, their wickedness, even though God is using them, God's also going to bring judgment on them for the way they acted, the way they inflicted punishment, and how they're treating the people that they're oppressing. And down verse 6. Of course, here's Assyria. He talks about, "I will send it against a godless nation." Of course, that's the, here's talking about Judah, and also probably including, talking about Judah, describing it as a godless nation. "And commission against the people of my fury to capture booty and to seize plunder and to trample them down like mud in the streets." Okay, so here we find, how Israel had turned. You know, note God's description of his people, right? He calls them here a godless nation. American Standard has the a profane nation, where the King James Version has a hypocritical nation. And so God's just not going to stand by for their iniquity. He's going to use Assyria to enslave them and to oppress them. Let's look at verses 13 and 14. Here you find the indictment more specific against Assyria. Note in verse 12, he's talking to Assyria. He says, "I will punish the fruit of the arrogant heart of the king of Syria and the pomp of his haughtiness." So here's talking to this nation that's bringing this oppression. And he's explaining why this judgment's come upon them. Verse 13, "For he has said, by the power of my hand and by my wisdom I did this. For I have understanding, and I removed the boundaries of the peoples and plundered their treasures. And like a mighty man I brought down their inhabitants. And my hand reached to the riches of the people like a nest, and one who gathers abandoned eggs. I gathered all the earth, and there was not one that flapped its wings or opened its beaks or chirped." So here we find that this nation evidently was very proudful, and they said, "Well, it was by my own might that we were able to conquer the northern kingdom and then doing this oppression." So God here is holding this nation accountable, and he cites that very specifically. Okay, let's stop there. I almost finished, but a couple more sections and we'll be done. Let me quickly mention a couple of lessons. At the end of your lesson are some lessons. And the first thing to note, lessons I get out of this section here, we talked about 8:10, about how God makes a plan that cannot be thwarted. I think it's an important lesson for us to keep in mind. God has plans for us, right? We're going to be a resurrection of the body. We're going to face Christ on Judgment Day. Going to be an end. We're going to stand before Christ. You know, that's God's plan. We can't thwart God's plan. It's going to happen. And just like 8:10 says about God's plan, that it will be accomplished. It will come to pass. 8:10 and also 7:7. The last one here is about God being with us. Even though this was a wicked nation, Isaiah has warned the other country, you know, God is with this nation. God is with his people. And that should give us a tremendous amount of strength and encouragement about us. God is with us, his children. And it should give us a lot of hope and the troubles that we come across day by day. We should always be thinking, you know, who's got our back? You know, God's got our back. So God is with us. Okay, well, we'll stop here and we'll pick up, almost finished here, and then we'll go on to chapters 11 and 12, which will be a verse-by-verse analysis. That's a lesson number 12. So appreciate your good attention. Thank you.